Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Cersei Institute Podcast Network. I am David Kern, and since it's Close Reads, I am joined by Angelina Stanford and Tim McIntosh, my friends Angelina and Tim. How's it going, y'all?
What? Wait, did I get an upgrade? Or is it a downgrade?
It was just
I got a title and I don't know how to feel about it.
What's the down? What's friends? Like, what's the upgrade above friends that you could have been downgraded from? Like,
I don't know. Master? You know, I don't know. When a guy introduces you as his friend, that's almost always a bad thing. And here's my friend, Angelina. I feel like I suddenly just got, friend zoned on Close Read.
But what about Tim? Like, if I say that this is my friend Tim, no one thinks twice about it.
Maybe they should. Maybe I'm super sensitive to those kinds of labels, David. Just stop pressing on my bruises.
All right, you know what? We will back off the labels and I'll just say, people, Tim and Angelina are here. These are people.
It's really the safest thing.
Yeah, probably.
Because I overthink everything.
Tim, you're here too, right?
I am here.
What's up?
Tim's probably.
Angelina, you overthink everything?
I know. Like, shocking. I know.
So I got to tell you a story. So
I want to hear it, David.
So my sister and her husband and her daughter just got back in town. They live on upstate New York, where they are my brother-in-law's in the army, and they live at an army base up there. And so they got home last night. So after doing some Christmas shopping, I dropped in to play a little bit of FIFA with my brother-in-law, like one does, right? Some video games
at the Kern house. That's how it rolls. Yes.
Yeah, well, now people are gonna think less of us, but that's all right. So
people don't understand that the Kern house, that is FIFA central, man, and they take it seriously.
Yeah, well, we hadn't been playing in a long time, so we're very rusty, I will say. So anyway, so I'm playing this video game, FIFA soccer video game, for those who don't know. And all of a sudden, my sister, we're sitting, it's kind of quiet. My sister, like, does one of those, hey, David things, you know, like she's going to say something. So it's, hey, David. And I was like, yep. And she goes, do you like doing Close Reads? And I was like,
what? Larissa, I'm right there with you. I have the same thing. Bethany has to convince me that you're having a good time. Anyway, continue.
So she goes, so I said, wait, what do you mean by that? She's like, no, she didn't really explain it. And then my brother-in-law goes, oh yeah, you guys are pretty good on that. We were listening to that on the way up here. And then at one point we were talking about the show a little bit, and my brother-in-law goes, he goes, you know, it's really funny because sometimes you guys will make great points, and then next thing I know, you're just talking about candy.
And you said, exactly right.
I was like, yeah, that sounds about, I feel like you're listening to the right show there.
Yeah. So David, did your sister ask that because why did she ask?
Oh, I don't really know. I mean, maybe I don't sound excited to be on the show with you guys. I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know.
I think you sound more excited now. Once I got to see your face when we started doing it in person, then I realized you were having a good time.
So I've got a face for radio?
You have a face for dampened enthusiasm. No, you have a voice for dampened enthusiasm, I guess.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've actually thought about this. I don't know why we're talking about this on the show. It's sort of nonsense, but I've thought about how I should speak on these different podcasts. So like, I practice sometimes, especially for intros. And I've always known that, like, in the old days of radio, I would never be on the radio, right? I don't have a voice that's like deep and like, I'm going to do announcing for like the movie trailers or something.
In a world where books are read closely.
Yeah, exactly. In a world. I thought about that, and I thought about, like, should I try to have extra enthusiasm? Should I try to be more serious? Should I try to talk more formally? Or should I just sound like my nasally weird self? And I just decided it's a lot easier to just go, be myself. It's just a lot less work.
I agree.
Okay, so yeah, I'm going to throw out my crazy Angelina theory on this, because I noticed that I tend to have two very different effects on people when I talk to them, right? So I just assumed that this is what was happening. Effect number one, they get caught up in my enthusiasm, and then they end up feeding my enthusiasm, and we become like an enthusiasm tornado together. And then there are other people that the more enthusiastic I get, it's like then they become even calmer. Like, they're trying to create balance in the universe as they talk to me. which of course just makes me want to be more enthusiastic to get them up, and it becomes a vicious cycle. So I just assumed you were person number two, and like, the more hyper excited I get, you're like, and calm down, Angelina.
Well, there is a different, the host, I feel like my job is to just keep things. So, I mean, let me rephrase that. My job is to pretend that I'm here to keep things moving and occasionally make an attempt at that. Speaking of which, we probably should talk about 12th Night.
I don't know why.
Chapter five.
Yeah. We're here to talk about act five. Before we do talk about that, I want to just remind people that if you are a Patreon supporter, if you're a patron, we have posted a bonus show this week with Benedict Whalen, Dr. Benedict Whalen from Hillsdale College. He and I chatted a little bit about teaching Shakespeare and why he loves it and some particular things about this play. So some extra bonus content there. Another story, my brother got back from college a couple days ago and he was sitting on the couch with us last night and he was telling me that people at Hillsdale, Dr. Whalen is one of the most beloved professors there. So that's a little support for his appearance on the show, I guess. But I enjoyed the conversation and had some good feedback so far. So if you have not gotten to listen to that yet, you can head over to patreon.com/closereads and check that episode out. If you want to get access to that, then you can become a patron. And I think you could even get access to that at the $2 a month level. So again, that's patreon.com/closereads. So let's go ahead and talk about Act 5 now. This is Act 5, and it is all of one scene long. So here's my question for you Shakespeare scholars, the two of you, of course. Is it common that the final act is a single scene in Shakespeare?
I'd have to look it up, but I would probably say that's pretty common. I mean, Taming the Shrew has two scenes, which it's actually unusual, I think. I mean, Act 5 is always super fast. I don't know off the top of my head how many scenes.
But they're usually, as far as pacing goes, it usually is very speedy.
Oh, yes. Things are resolved quickly. There's always the sudden reversal and the recognition scene. They come right together. So it's boom, 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 resolution.
Tim, does that ever cause disorientation for you?
That it's so rapid?
Yeah.
Well, it's funny thing is, I agree. I can think of a few Shakespeare plays where it's, oh my goodness, it's a laborious conclusion. I mean, Measure for Measure, for me, it kind of drags. The conclusion kind of drags. I think it might be, and I don't think it's all one scene typically. I mean, you know, there'd be kind of an empirical way to test this. We just look at the conclusions of the plays, but
sometimes
just based on my memory.
I feel like we should ask these questions before we start recording, because this would be easily remedied.
Yeah, but then I would have to, then it would seem like I asked you ahead of time.
Okay, so I just randomly flipped to Love's Labour's Lost, and let's see what Act 5 is. Yeah. It has two scenes.
Okay.
Two scenes in that one.
Okay, so I'm interested in this idea of the rapidity of these endings, or the suddenness of them, the sudden reversal, and then the resolution.
And because, David, let me just say before you jump into this, I when I was going through Act 5, I thought, wow, this is so thrifty. This is so unlike Shakespeare's Act 5s. Sometimes they're thrifty, but oftentimes I kind of want to be like, hey, Will, let's get a move on, buddy.
I should define my terms when I mean. Well, first of all, the comedies are going to be much faster at the end than the tragedies, because the tragedies have the long, you know, 14 pages of, and I die, and yet I still die, and also I'm still dying. So I'm specifically talking about the comedies, where it's this very, very sudden. Like, so the plot has been going on a trajectory toward down, 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 right, as the tangle gets worse, and they go further into their symbolic death. And when they come out of that, the coming out of the death is very fast. And I don't necessarily mean, like, in terms of time, but that in terms of, like, the preparation for it, it's meant to be sudden and miraculous. So it's not going to be a slow build to the untangling, but some, you know, piece of paper with the is found under some, stuck under somebody's shoe, right? That kind of thing. And then they open it up and that's the clue that unravels the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like it's very, the unraveling of the knot happens in a snap. It's meant to be very sudden and miraculous.
So do you ask?
And a tragedy has that much more of that slow build of inevitability as everything just sort of avalanches and falls down on you.
So do you either of you find, as I put it a minute ago, the sort of the rapid breakneck pace and the suddenness to be disorienting at all?
You were talking about in this play?
Yeah, we'll go with this play, but in general, when that happens like that. But we'll just stick with the 12th night particularly.
I found this a little bit, having not read it for a while, I thought that there was going to be more of a betrothal and maybe even, I want to say, I keep going back to Measure for Measure. I want to say the betrothal is relatively long in Measure for Measure. This was, a little bit so rapid that I got, unnerved is the right word. I was just surprised. It seemed to me like he left a lot of things intentionally undone that in other comedies he puts a bow on. For example, Malvolio, he's not restored. He's not, justice is not done on his behalf or anything like that. He just kind of escapes in complaint of the injustice done to him. And that's the last we see of him. And there's no real justice performed on Sir Toby and Sir Andrew. There's not, this kind of like betrayal in which they fake the letter from their mistress to Malvolio. There's sort of a half-hearted apology, and that's left undone. So again, for me, I think this is even by the romance, even by the comedies, this struck me as a really rapid wrap up. And there are a lot of things left undone. And that for me is a little bit of a exception rather than the rule for Shakespeare's comedies.
Hmm. Is it my turn now?
Yeah. I was just gonna say, Angelina. What are you?
Well, typically, no, I don't find them to be abrupt or disorienting because I come to I expect it. But in terms of what Tim is saying, in terms of the loose ends, I agree. One of the things that we have not talked about that I hoped we would get to today is the subtitle of the play. It's Twelfth Night.
It's on my list.
Awesome. So, yes, I think that there is some intentional ambiguity at the end and what you will, right? How he's throwing it to the audience to interpret the ending. So I agree that things are not as tidily, even the marriages. So you have the resolution with the marriages, but, and again, this is something I hope we'll delve into deeper, but we've been talking about this excess and these characters are drowning in emotion, right? And the two characters who are not that way, three, if you count Fest, but in terms of these love stories, you have Viola and Sebastian, right? The two who did not drown. Everyone's drowning, and they're the two that did not drown, right? And so they're these elevated characters. So in a typical Act 5 reversal with the resolution and the redemption, it's clear that a redemption has happened. And part of what Tim might be feeling is that that is not clear at the end of this play. That is intentionally ambiguous. Harold Godner, who I've talked about, he wrote The Meaning of Shakespeare, that particular scholar, he says this, which I think is super interesting, that so he traces the idea of Viola and Sebastian as being like the stable characters who are elevated. And typically what's going to happen is those marriages are going to be redemptive to the characters. But here in this play, it's intentionally ambiguous. So at the end, you're left asking, is Viola marrying Orsino going to redeem him and help him to become the man he needs to be? Likewise with Sebastian and Olivia. Well, will she become, will they both stop being the overly sentimental people and step into some real emotion? Or will they just end up dragging Viola and Sebastian down with them? And it's not resolved at the end And that's part of the reason why you just have Malvolio lecturing them and walking off the stage, because what you end up thinking about Malvolio has to do with what you think about the ending of the play as a whole, right? Like, so some of these things have to be intentionally left open, because he doesn't tidy it up. It's not so clear in this topsy-turvy world whether or not things have actually been righted, or if Viola and Sebastian will be just sucked into the topsy-turviness.
Yeah. So what do you think of Malvolio?
I'm not a fan, but Charles Lamb was famously thought that he was horribly mistreated, and at the end of this play has a great deal of dignity and never loses his dignity and kind of walks off the champion in that match.
So
Charles
so
you, Lamb of, you know, Lamb Shakespeare.
But you disagree
in
that,
that match. What do you mean in that match, Angelina?
Well, you know, when he sort of tells them all off at the end.
Yeah.
Y'all were wrong treating me like this.
Right. I just thought I was confused with the word match. Never mind.
Oh no, not like romantic match, right. Like in the fight, in the squaring off of the characters where he's
the bout. Got it.
Yeah, right, yeah, right.
I see.
Oh, I thought she was talking about like you light a fire with it.
We took three different meanings of the word.
No. Okay. So, but Angelina, you disagree. You do not think that Malvolio ends this play with a sense of dignity.
Well, it's not my gut feeling, but I mean, I wouldn't necessarily rule it all out. I mean, Malvolio is not a super interesting character to me, so I can't say that I've given him a ton of thought.
Well, let's go back. I want to go back to this idea of the sympathy towards Malvolio, because I think revisiting at the end, I asked that question a couple episodes ago. How much sympathy you have for Malvolio. Does that change getting to the end of the play for you?
There are two opposite ways you can read the ending. And I think a lot of it has to do on what you think of him, right? So either he's this, Puritan killjoy who really needs to be taken down a peg. And they do that to him. And then at the end, of course, he hasn't learned the lesson. He's unredemptive because he is still telling them, how dare you treat me like this, right?
Yeah, so he's just kind of doubled down. His last line is about revenge.
Right. So he's double downing on his position. So either you think he deserved it, and so at the end, he's unrepentant and didn't learn the lesson, or you think that he didn't deserve it and therefore is right at the end to hold on to his dignity and to say that they were in the wrong.
And where do you fall?
I'm not a big Malvolio fan. I mean, I will say this. Okay, so a couple of people on the Facebook page felt like what happened to him was, you know, it crossed the line to sadism, which it did, no doubt. But again, the rules of a play are not exactly like the rules of reality. It's kind of like, you know, Looney Tunes violence, right? Like, you know, there's certain conventions at play where, you know, if a character deserves to be made fun of, they're going to do some kind of really over the top thing. And then a play like this, where everything is over the top, then even the practical joke is going to be way beyond any kind of good sense.
Right.
So, I understand the people on the Facebook page who felt sympathy to Malvolio because being imprisoned and, you know, tortured till you think you're mad is that's pretty, you know, no one deserves that. Agreed. And I don't think Shakespeare is saying that an actual person deserves that. But, you know, taking the conventions as a whole, you know, it's everything in this play is an extreme version of something. And so the practical joke is also an extreme version. But what, you know, to speak to what Tim said about Malvolio is kind of, you know, unresolved at the end. That's true. In a typical Shakespeare play, Shakespeare is going to come down one way or the other and make it clear, but he doesn't. I imagine this would be one of the things too, where a particular actor's interpretation of the character would have a lot of influence on what you thought of it as well.
Yeah. The way you deliver the lines. I mean, cause even that I'll be revenged on the whole pack of you line at the end of like Malvolio's last line could be presented very angrily and aggressively, or it could be.
And triumphantly, or it could just be ridiculous, right?
It could be, yeah, it could be forlorn. It could be like Rabbit from Winnie the Pooh.
I felt so much sympathy with him at the end.
Okay, good.
He was such a buffoon even through chapter three, but once he went into the prison, I just felt like, okay, you guys, hey, the joke is up. You know, the joke is up. We have to kind of see through the joke because people have got to get married here at the end. But it just seemed to step over the line. And I kind of hope he does get some revenge on Toby and Andrew. I mean, Toby and Andrew are just such
jerks.
Oh, they're just so spineless. They're spineless jerks. And granted, I mean, I think Malvolio was a jerk, a jerk with a spine earlier in the play, but I just felt like he's being punished by two cads. You know, they're barely on this side of villainy themselves. And I kind of hope offstage there is some sort of, you know, balancing of the scales.
So,
there's no question that Toby and Andrew are horrible. I know one of the other interesting things in terms of how this is typically resolved is you have the resolution at the end of a comedy where the community comes back together. So the fact that you have so many people off stage at the end of this is also unusual. So Malvolio makes the speech and then leaves, but Toby and Andrew and Maria, the culprits, right? They're not in this. They're missing. So they never get reintegrated into the society. So if you read the ending as now there is a redemption, the marriages are going to be redempted, society is going to change, then those people obviously don't have a place in it. They have not been reintegrated.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like when they last each speak, because they leave and they don't really get to.
Are they even in Act Four?
You're talking about Toby and Andrew?
Yeah, they are. They're in the first scene.
Yeah, the fight.
So they are in Act Four.
And they're only and in then Toby five, a little bit.
Is Maria.
Say that again, sorry.
Which is a weird resolution. Toby marries Maria, which is a weird resolution.
Yeah, that is.
Because then Maria ends up accomplishing what she punished Malvolio for wanting.
Well, I will say regarding that, that's the only relationship where I look at that and say, okay, there's a logical sense behind their partnership.
Yeah, right. They deserve each other.
There's that, but you also have seen it building, right? Like they've been teasing each other and flirting in all those sort of ways throughout the whole thing, as opposed to Sebastian, who sees Olivia and falls in love within like a quarter of a second. As soon as he shows affection in him, he's like, she loves me, I love her.
you know,
do that you guys... just true to me, David. I don't understand what the problem is with that.
I didn't say there was a problem. I just said it wasn't
logical. 12th Night struck me as a play that was kind of similar to Merchant of Venice. Merchant of Venice is not...
That's interesting.
I don't know. Merchant of Venice is kind of hard to place. It's not a comedy. The people get married, you know. It's kind of a dramedy, I guess, in some ways. The end of Merchant of Venice is one of the most perplexing conclusions to a play. And it really, it's almost like a Rorsch inkblot test for where you stand about a lot of things, but especially about Christian society. Shakespeare lived in a Christian society that was kind of like going back and forth between Protestantism and Catholicism. So we lived in a Christian society that was kind of like, you know, still in a dilemma between the two, between two major traditions. So at the end of Merchant of Venice, Shylock is found guilty of basically, let's call it extortion. And his punishment is basically to become a Christian. He has to swear off the old faith and align himself with the new faith. And it's really troubling. It's a really troubling conclusion because he does seem to be in some ways guilty of extortion, but in some ways he actually just fulfilled his end of the bargain of a contract that was based on, oh gosh, his own like kind of bloodthirsty sense of revenge. He wanted a pound of flesh. That's the conclusion of the contract. And the contract is failed by the opposite party. I hope I'm remembering all this right. The Christian party. And Shylock is kind of brought before the judge, and the judge kind of obligates him to become a Christian. And when he leaves the stage, this defeated party, but you also feel like sort of justice has been done to him. And in doing that justice, it is a gross injustice. So some people say this is Shakespeare, the humanist, who is pointing out how this Christian society did Shylock wrong. But how much can Shakespeare actually point that out in the Elizabethan England that he lives in? Can he actually just say exactly what the injustice is that's being done against Shylock? No, he probably can't. He can't do that. So he basically shows the injustice by having Shylock leave the stage, suffering what looks like an injustice, even though in some ways it fulfills the contract that everyone signed up for. For some reason, although the subject is different, Twelfth Night feels that way to me. It feels like Shakespeare's deliberately leaving undone things so that we kind of have to rattle that play around in our chests a little bit longer.
Well, that's very consistent with what Harold Godder says. So he thinks that Shakespeare is making a comment on, the prosperity of Elizabethan society, that you become this excessive, and we saw it in the Roman era, we have it in our own era now, when you reach a certain level of prosperity and peace and comfort, right, you go soft as a culture. You become very pleasure-seeking and that kind of thing. And of course, that was very true of that age in Elizabethan England. And so Harold Godder thinks that he's making a comment on that and leaving it open-ended by telling the audience what you will, like you decide, right? And so one of the things he points out is that this is a free society in Twelfth Night. It's free, but they are enslaved. They're enslaved to their pleasure and to pleasure-seeking, which is basically a comment on Elizabethan England, but that's part of the reason why it's open ended. It's tossing it out to the audience. What you will, like, what do you say about the world that we live in, and how do we get out of this? And are we all enslaved in pleasure? So the audience can then decide how to read Act Five. Do Viola, Olivia and Orsino need to snap out of it, or do they need to double down?
Yeah.
Do you think that in doing that, the play lacks not finality, or do you think in that sort of stasis, it lacks catharsis?
Mm.
Is that a fair way of, I don't know if that's a fair way of questioning it or asking that, phrasing that question. It's clear that there's a stasis, which is, even though they're going to have these relationships, there's not, as you guys have said, it's not implied that they're necessarily going to be healthy relationships or what you will. There doesn't seem to be that, like, maybe it's the pace, maybe it's the suddenness of it, but it seems like it lacks in some ways the cathartic resolution, or the catharsis that resolution can sometimes.
David, I agree. The pace did not bother me. The pace didn't bother me, and I found it very satisfying when Viola, it's revealed. Viola didn't do all these wonderful things, all these awful things. She's a woman dressed as a man, and all the masks come off. That part I thought was just delightful. But I do think that, like, at the end of the play, the end of the play is strangely, it's not like it's not satisfying, but it's not terribly cathartic. Whereas the end of, why am I striking out? Beatrice and Benedict.
Much Ado About Nothing.
It's so cathartic. It's just so wonderful. because the power of the two characters that we know belong together, they finally get together. And it even almost over, it kind of almost, the joy of that relationship almost overwhelms the other problem in the play, which is, what is the name of the woman that was so done wrong by her fiance, Hero.
Hero.
It almost makes us forget like how done wrong Hero was.
So that's one thing I want to talk about here, because in that play, you have the two marriages, the two primary marriages at the end of Much Ado, are both, there's catharsis in it, and in that resolution, because there's been conflict between both, within both those relationships throughout the play. Beatrice and Benedict have been at each other's throat.
And Benedict have both had some kind of transformation that makes the ending feel like they've grown into this person, right?
Yeah, yeah.
For what it's worth, that's the next play that I want to do. Next time we do a play, I want to do
good,
that.
Good, good, good.
That's my favorite Shakespeare play, too. So,
you know, I don't disagree with what you guys are saying. And I'm wondering how much of this has to do with the form of this play. Because, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, but for me, when I think about catharsis in a story, that has a lot to do with how much I'm identifying with the characters, right? And going on this journey with the characters.
For people to be.
But I don't know that I feel something for Viola. I want to see her get her day, right? But the others, you know, not so much invested. I mean, if Olivia gets Sebastian, I mean, we're not rooting for that because it happened so quickly. And I'm wondering if I'm not suggesting it's a flaw or a lack of character development, but I'm wondering if the whole screwball comedy, madcap antics nature of it creates a little distance from it.
No, I think that's possible. I think that's very possible. And so one of the things about the catharsis is there's catharsis or like a real sense of resolution comes, there has to be sort of a conflict there. And who's the real character that we're getting any sort of conflict or that experiences any sort of conflict that actually matters? Really, it's just, with at least within the play, it's just Malvolio, right? He's the only one that really experiences true conflicts. I mean, I know that like Viola was on a ship that was sinking and all that. That's true, but that's not part of the play. Like, we don't experience that with her.
Whereas, so David, what you're saying is Orsino doesn't really experience conflict. He more experiences confusion, and same thing.
Yeah, like all the other conflict, like the play essentially makes fun of them for.
Right, right.
In a way, it teases them.
Yes, and we don't see Orsino or Olivia go through any kind of personal transformation, right? Mm-hmm. They just are crazy in love with one person and then crazy in love with a different person at the end of the play. But we don't see them experience, and that's part of the open-endedness of the conclusion, is that have they grown up? Have they changed?
And they haven't fallen. Yes, I'm sorry. I thought you were. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, are they still as flighty and over sentimental as ever? And they've just found a new object for their sentiment.
Right, because they haven't fallen in love with someone new because they are a new person, because they have changed,
right?
Learned to see other people in a different way. It's just because they're the same person they always were, which implies that could happen again.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason to think that Orsino won't find someone else who he is taken with and turn from Viola.
Whereas Benedict, you cannot imagine him being with anyone ever for the rest of his life other than Beatrice.
It's been earned. It's been earned.
Yeah, it's been earned.
It feels right because you feel like they deserve each other, and you don't feel... except for, as we said, Maria and Toby, but we mean that in a negative way. But yes, I mean, even Sebastian trying to make the case that Olivia is constant, because you really were in love with me when you were in love with my sister pretending to be a man.
He's trying to talk them into it. Like, it's like they're trying to make their consciences feel better.
Yeah, like, this isn't weird that you were in love with my sister, and now you thought I was her, and now you're in love. This isn't weird, because really, you were just in love with me all.
It's like one of Shakespeare's, someone read the play, like one of his actors read the play, and they were like giving him notes like, this is a little bit off. And then like they went back and rewrote it and like had to build in excuses into the narrative to make us not just like think it's ridiculous.
Was a lot of, that's not weird, like lines, right? This isn't weird.
Don't worry.
You know, and Orsino's like, wait a minute. So when you said you would never love a woman as much as you love me, what? I get it now. Okay, I'm in. Boom.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, you're still dressed as a man, and I have never seen you as a woman, but I'm in.
when in other habits you are seen, I promise I'm going to love you. I promise.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's like he's trying to convince himself too, right?
Keep dressing like a boy and I will keep calling you Cesario.
So basically, this is a play about 13-year-olds. But now we've kind of been giving negative feedback on the play, like talking about where maybe there's some limitations, and but it might be the nature of the kind of play. Now, I'm wondering two things. Is the screwball nature of it, as you've put, Angelina, is that perhaps necessary because it's tied to either the season, that whole Christmas season thing,
the 12th revelry, right?
Yeah, the revelry. Is it tied to that? And then also, I want to talk about the song or the poem at the end of the play.
Yes.
And figure out how those two things are tied into maybe the subtitle. So let's talk about the madcap revelry and how that plays into some of these resolutions or not. And I wonder if either of you have any thoughts on that. That is a very general and open-ended question of which you are trained not to do when you're interviewing somebody. But this is not an interview. This is a conversation.
You don't interview us as much as you throw raw meat at us rabid dogs and then watch us fight over it.
Exactly. Okay, get it. Go at it, hyenas. Go at it.
I guess I'm not really understanding the difference between that question and what we've just talked about.
Okay, well, I just mean, because we've kind of talked about it, like maybe this is a flaw of the play. So what I'm saying...
Well, I don't think it's a flaw. I think this is inherent in the form. I think this is meant to be just a kind of surface screwball comedy. He's obviously capable of writing characters that you really root for and are wonderful, and his female characters are fantastic in other plays. You know, Olivia's not so much to write about.
Okay, so then let me ask this. Does that make Twelfth Night a lesser play than Much Ado About Nothing, for example? Like, does that inherently make it lesser play just based on the form he's using? Not because he's doing that form wrong, but because of the form he's using, does that make it a lesser play than some of the other ones?
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It has to do with the form, you know, like, so a Weird Al song is not a symphony, right? So, and the symphony is greater, and the Weird Al song could be the best song parody you ever heard, and you might applaud it, and it might be excellent for its form, but it's not a symphony.
And it won't affect you by a symphony. There's a place for a symphony, and there's a place for a comedic.
That's right. And look, and all of us have those moments, right? Because I see your Facebook post. We all have those moments where we're like, just recommend a dumb, stupid comedy to me. I just want to laugh and, you know, not have the cathartic moment.
So it's interesting because
there's a place for more force and light comedy. And then of course there's lots of room for Much Ado About Nothing.
I like to compare Shakespeare sometimes, or at least not try to understand Shakespeare this way, but in my own mind, compare him to filmmakers because it helps me contextualize things. And sometimes, like, I don't know if you guys know the films of Billy Wilder very well. But there's certain films like The Apartment, which is a dramedy, which is a very deep, it's funny and there's screwball elements to it, but it's mostly in wordplay and it's got dark moments, even as it's got light moments, much like Much Ado About Nothing. But then you've got something like Some Like It's Hot or Some Like It Hot, which is this cross-dressing, very screwball comedy, which is much more like 12th Night. But the same director who can master these two different forms 2 years apart. And they're both amazing movies. Like Some Like It Hot is one of Josh Gibbs' favorite movies. It's an amazing movie. But The Apartment by Billy Wilder, while also a comedy, is a very different kind of comedy, but he's mastering. Both of them are great movies within the canon. Both are movies that everyone should watch, but he's mastering a genre, but a different sort of form within that genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think a lot of it has to do with your expectations of whether or not you feel disappointed, right? If you put on Some Like It Hot and you're expecting to see Hamlet, you're going to at the end say, what did I just watch? This was no good.
Or even if you put on Dumb and Dumber expecting You've Got Mail, they're both comedies, but they branch off
totally in different
specific ways.
Right, right.
Any sort of savvy watcher, though, picks up those differences relatively rapidly, especially if you've had any sort of acquaintance with movies, with genres. You know within 10 minutes that, well, you know within 5 minutes that Dumb and Dumber is not going to be You've Got Mail. I think that part of the reason that Twelfth Night falls short of the classic Shakespeare comedies is because he chose a form, and I think he deliberately tinkers with it, but I think in his tinkering with it, we get to the end, and it becomes more of a... he kind of is like throwing elements of a different genre in there, and I think in this situation, it doesn't work. Now, with Measure for Measure, I think Measure for Measure, and I think Merchant of Venice, he tinkers with the form also, but I think it's successful. I think when he tinkers with the form, what happens with the characters is very rewarding, very satisfying. And I think Twelfth Night, it's a wonderful play. It's Shakespeare. Big picture, it's a success. But I just don't think that it compares with Much Ado, Measure for Measure.
You wouldn't say it's top five comedy?
No. Not for me.
Do you guys think that possibly the length, like it's shorter than some of his other comedies for sure. So do you think that maybe he could use more length to flesh out some of these characters?
Well, see, but I'm wondering what happens to the theme if he fleshes out the characters more. Like, so if in his mind he wants to tell a play about superficial sentiment and people not being deep, but just pleasure-seeking people. And he wants them to pretty much be the same throughout the whole play so that at the end you're not sure if they've changed or not. Uh-huh. Then he can't develop them too much.
Yeah, I agree.
No, yeah. That's
he's got to lock them into adolescence in a way.
Right. And so we don't feel like, yay, Orsino and Viola, they finally got, yes, the stars have aligned and their souls are one. And we certainly don't feel that way about Viola and Sebastian, because we're like, man, you don't even know which sibling you're in love with.
Yeah.
Which I want to point out, too, and then this would be one of those moments where you have to see it versus reading it. But on the stage, they would not have actually looked like twins, nor would they have been wearing the same clothes. And so that would have made the whole thing much more hilarious.
Yeah.
The mistaken identity where they don't actually look alike. And it was how could Olivia have been confused about who she was talking to?
Doesn't it say in the play that they wear the same clothes? That she dresses up to look like him?
Yes, but they're not. I mean, they're wearing the same type of clothes, but they're not literally wearing the same outfit.
Right.
Because
it's
been 3 months.
Right. Yeah. 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 yeah, that's funny.
Speaking of the staging, there were a few moments that I just, because we had talked about how Shakespeare builds in stage directions into the dialogue, I made note of a few things, and I thought it might be worth mentioning just because I love it. So
go for it. We'll do that, and then I want to talk about the poem at the end.
So Antonio, have you made division of yourself? This is when Antonio sees his master Sebastian, also sees Viola, and doesn't understand, oh my goodness, how can there be two of you? How have you made division of yourself? An apple cut in two is not more twin than these two creatures. Which is Sebastian? And then the next line is from Olivia, and it's most wonderful. And then Sebastian, do I stand there? I never had a brother, blah, blah, blah. Viola's line, how wonderful. When you guys read it, what did you do with that? Because it's not germane. It doesn't feel terribly germane.
You mean like, what did I imagine she's doing?
Yeah, right.
I think it'd be pretty cool if they were like standing face to face and she's like, they're like looking in a mirror. They're doing that little number. How do you imagine it?
I just imagine that's the moment where that's when she first sees Viola as a man, not as Cesario, but as Viola.
Wait, when who sees it?
When Olivia sees, that's the moment I think that she first recognizes, and her action changes after that. It's not Cesario anymore. That's a woman. But Shakespeare doesn't explain, I mean, he doesn't say, this is the moment of recognition. He doesn't say Olivia sees Viola Sebastian. I mean, she doesn't.
Yeah, there's no exposition. And in that moment.
There's no exposition. Yeah.
A great.
Another one.
Explain the Duke, his changed behavior toward Viola. So if we're supposed to understand, right, that some kind of transformation has happened in this character and now she seems more feminine, is that what you're saying?
No. I just think it's. I don't think that anything changes in the appearance of Viola. I just think Olivia, that's the moment where she recognizes.
I'm confused because
Yeah.
Because you called it a stage direction. I see what you're saying.
No, it's not. There is no stage direction, even though I think that the stage direction is in the dialogue. Most wonderful. That's when Olivia gets it.
So Shakespeare, okay, so he's burying the stage direction in there, you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, right. So another one, Viola says she's talking to Sebastian, and this is after it's been revealed she is not a man. She is Viola. She is not Sebastian, or she is not Cesario. If nothing lets to make us happy both, but this my masculine usurped attire, do not embrace me till each circumstance of place, time, fortune, do cohere and jump that I am Viola. Do not embrace me is the middle line in that. I think that's a stage. That's Shakespeare telling the Sebastian actor to go embrace her. And then Viola says, do not embrace me. But it's not written anywhere.
Oh, right.
It's no, you know, other than that dialogue, it's not written anywhere.
Well, it's certainly whether Shakespeare would have had his actors do that. It seems likely that he would have, given that it's there and all that. But it's at least a place to be imaginative for the performer, right? And there is like a blank slate thing about his plays in a way that you can use the language to, you know, just guide your imagination or like kind of create structure for your imagination.
You know, that is one of the things about Shakespeare. I almost wish we could do an entire, this could be a fun close reads, is do like three different productions of something like Macbeth or Merchant of Venice and see just how differently the interpretations can be, because they can be legitimately profoundly different, which gets into a whole question of kind of like, authorial intent. You know, like I'm a big believer in authorial intent. That's kind of like what you're trying to understand before you apply a book to yourself, is you're trying to understand what did this author mean. And Shakespeare kind of throws a wrench in all that, because just what you said, David, it's so true. There's so much room, there's so much wiggle room, there's so much opportunity to make Richard III a somewhat sympathetic character. You know, he's got a club foot and a hunchback. Maybe you can play him really sympathetic, or maybe you can play Macbeth as, you know, a story about the rise of the Third Reich. It kind of mimics the rise of the Third Reich. I've seen that production of Richard III.
That was totally intentional too. It's amazing.
By Shakespeare?
Yeah, he consulted the oracles and was like, damn. Yep.
But yeah, Shakespeare is there is a blank slate for your imagination there.
Yeah.
Or not, maybe not blank, because there's language that's there, but he is creating a platform or a playground for a performer, a reader, a director to be imaginative. He's not a dictator as an artist.
No.
He creates a big
platform with simple architecture, and the architecture, you can't really move the pillars of the architecture very much, but you can move all around and under and through those pillars in the when you're designing the performance.
Yeah, and so as strange as it might sound, considering other things that I have said on the show about, you know, how I feel about the written word, I don't have a problem with those kinds of interpretations. One of the reasons why, so like, you know, Kenneth Branagh making Hamlet in, you know, Edwardian, right? Isn't that what he does? I've never seen that one, but he
yeah,
makes
he
it
does.
More.
Really? You should watch that. You'd like it.
Yeah, I should. I just never watch movies. But anyway, that's an issue for another day. But part of the reason I don't have any problem with that is because Shakespeare himself played so fast and loose with historical fact. Right? He was always maneuvering things to bring out sort of contemporary themes and issues. And he was not a historian, right? He was a playwright. These are works of the imagination. So he would change things. You know, even the play Macbeth, for example, the actual historical record of Macbeth is almost the opposite of what we see in the play in terms of whether or not Macbeth was a good guy or a bad guy. And but he did that because, you know, King James is on the throne and he's the legendary descendant of Banquo. And so he writes this whole thing and it's kind of a nod to James on the throne. And so the point is, Shakespeare himself was not opposed to moving things around historically to make some contemporary issues and themes become more apparent. And so, honestly, that's part of the genius of Shakespeare, right? That they're these amazing works of imagination. Yeah. And they're brilliant and they're brilliantly structured and crafted. And yet there's weird flexibility in it too, so that you can do a lot with it and it still be Shakespeare.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm.
When I'm trying to think, is there anyone else that's like that?
Boy, no one comes to mind. No one comes to mind.
Well, let's sort of wrap this up by talking about the poem at the end. We're going to get lots of questions from people. So again, if you have questions, post them on the Facebook page. We'll create a thread for that and we'll talk about those next week. But let's go ahead and talk about this poem to wrap up this episode, and then we'll address anything else that comes up in those questions. Hold on.
What to do with the poem?
Yeah. And my computer just started telling me, do you want to leave this meeting? No, I'd rather not leave this meeting right now.
You'd rather stay this meeting?
I'd rather keep this going. Okay. So, okay. The poem at the end. What does this have to do with this subtitle, with the themes that are going on here, with the this sort of, you know, slapstick comedy element that's going on?
Well, okay, so I'll give this a shot. And this is me kind of sort of processing this out loud, right? So this isn't like my definitive answer, but this is the sorts of things that are kind of rolling around in my head as we've talked. Because it sort of changed a little bit what I thought was going on. And that didn't change, but fleshed it out somewhat. So first of all, it's the clown, right? And we've talked about him as being somebody who's not sucked into this sentiment and this drunkenness, and who is a little bit different than a typical Shakespeare fool in that he seems to be hyper self-aware. So, you know, a clown in Shakespeare always confuses and twists things around, but this clown has that self-reflective moment where he says, I'm confusing you with my words. I am beguiling you. He's in the play, but also sort of outside of the play as this commentator on everything that's going on, right? Almost in this postmodern, hey, we are now in the part of the play where, you know, really, really drawing attention to it. So the fact that he's at the end, this guy who's sort of been commenting on the thing, that makes sense. And it gives, of course, weight to what he's saying. But it's also going to have that ambiguity because he's the clown. And you expect him to say something stupid at the end, right? Mm-hmm. And so you look through what he says, and it's this mix of this sort of playfulness stuff, but also this dark, but it's going to rain every day. It's going to rain every day, which is, this is very different than the whole theme of we're in paradise and we're all in love with love and everything's great. I mean, these stories are supposed to end with happily ever after, and they rode off into the sunset, not with, and it rained every single day. That's quite a comment. But then I'm also thinking about what you said about how everybody in this play is 13 years old, because the clown picks up that idea. He's basically saying, when I was a child, I did childish things. That's how it starts. When I was a little boy, I played with toys. And then he keeps going and says, but, you know, then you got to become a man when you want to get married. Now it's time not to be a kid and play with toys, because now you're going to get married. And then he goes the whole thing and says, you know, the play's done. So I think that just highlights what we've been saying. He's raising the question to the audience, are they all just kids playing with toys? But these relationships, are they going to man up and really have real marriages? So that's my 2 cents on that.
That makes sense to me. I mean, but when I came to man's estate, against knaves and thieves men shut their gate. But when I came, alas, to wive, by swaggering I could never thrive.
Yeah,
that right there seems to be like, it really supports Angelina's kind of assessment. Like, are these characters going to grow up and become adults now that they're getting married? Because the rain is going to come. And, you know, mm-hmm. the flood has been sort of synonymous with madness all throughout our play.
Yes.
So if we have, like, the rain is going to be here every day and madness is going to be at our doorstep every day, what are these characters going to do now that they've made this huge decision to marry up? Now what? It's kind of like, are they going to stay? You know what? This kind of makes sense. This might, I'm kind of like making the play sort of resolve a little bit for myself right now. This kind of, in a way, helps explain why Toby and Andrew just kind of get tossed off. They're not going to change. They're just going to continue being knaves. They're just going to continue drinking. And now we're on the threshold of two weddings. Are we going to see, or maybe three weddings, are we going to see a change in our four main characters? Are they going to grow up? I shouldn't say not all four characters that are getting married need to grow up.
I think the implication is that Viola and Sebastian are okay. It's the other
they're
two.
They're already there, right?
Yeah. Are Arsino and Olivia gonna grow up?
Yeah.
Which, you know, so this idea when they were kids and they were playing with toys, we've kind of been saying all along they're playing at being in love. They're playing at being mourning. All of their sentiments are just, they're just acting, and that's why you can just redirect it in whatever direction you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they have that. So then, of course, Olivia and Arsino have that very funny exchange in Act 5 where he says, oh, you're still so cruel. And she says, still so constant. Now that's hilarious. Because her constancy is that she switched from Viola to Sebastian and doesn't even realize it. And then he says, oh, no, my soul is the most faithful one. And they're both arguing about which one's the constant one between the two of them. And neither one of them is.
So this poem does have a little bit of that when I was a child. I saw as a child vibe to it.
Mm-hmm.
When that I was and a little tiny boy. And Tim, by the way, I was going to mention something that you actually did. And that's if you just read the first and third line of each stanza,
it's
actually interesting how it kind of falls together as well.
It makes a story. Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
Those middle lines, the in-between lines are a little bit almost like the magician doing something sleight of hand with his off hand so that he can actually do the trick with his right hand.
Oh yeah.
Those offline strikes me as distractions. Yeah. To tell the story, which is, it's kind of a serious moral story, a moral tale. It's got a point to it.
So, I wonder if in this sense is the clown, because he sings a few songs throughout, is he almost functioning like the chorus in a Greek play where he's commenting on the action?
Well, I think I feel like that's something I may have mentioned like in Act 1, that it felt like a chorus to me. But on the other hand, I may have not said that.
I think you did say that.
So I buy that idea. I haven't studied it closely to see if he's commenting throughout the whole thing, but I will say he certainly is commenting on whether or not the people around him are idiots.
Oh, right.
So there is that part of it. But I wanted to ask something about that then. So he says, when I was a little tiny boy, a foolish thing was but a toy. But when I came to man's estate, and this is Timur, this, against knaves and thieves, men shut their gate. Okay, so then he says, but when I came, alas, to wive, by swaggering, could I never thrive. So there's two interesting words that I want to ask about there. So it says, but when I came, alas, to wive. Why does it say alas? besides the meter. And then also by swaggering, could I never thrive? And swaggering here is bullying, according to my notes. So when I came alas to wives, so why is it alas to wives? And why is by bullying, could I never thrive? Is it bullying the wife? Is it bullying to acquire a wife? Is it bullying other? I mean, what's the, what is that? What's going on there?
I want to take issue with that in there that you've got, David. Why?
I was going to say, my mind defines it differently. Mine says blustering. What do you think, Tim?
Blustering. Bullying doesn't make any sense. And there's so much flexibility in that word. No, I think that's a bad end note, David.
Well, I'm going to check on my other version two to see what they
say. But I think blustering has the same sort of connotation of all that excessive sentiment we've been talking about, don't you? I mean, a guy
can bluster. Yeah.
Full hot air.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the swagger thing. You know, a dude who just like walks around with so much swagger.
Exactly.
And he doesn't even realize.
In other words, you can't pretend, right? You can't pretend because a swagger, a blusterer, he's pretending. That guy's a fraud. This is all a front, his a pretext right. of what a big tough guy is or whatever. But you can't do that.
I'm glad that your note says something different because I thought swagger, like, you know, that makes sense. And then the reason I asked about that word is because bullying didn't make sense to me. So I was wondering if there was there. But what about alas? But when I came alas to wife, is that just like alas because, oh, now I have to grow up?
See, like the actor in me wants to say, oh, that'd be, the actor can say that with a wink.
Okay. But when I came, like as a little aside, but when I came,
yeah,
alas, you know.
Yeah, he's winking at the audience. He's like, you know, I had to grow up. Okay. But we know this is the thing that you ought to do.
Okay.
You ought to grow up.
But I like this. I like the idea of the wink because, again, that intentional ambiguity. Is growing up bad? Or is it good? We've got to talk about a mirror to our own time. We can't decide if we should grow up or not. I mean, that song could be said about 2017 America right now, right? Everybody's just playing at love. Nobody's growing up and getting married. I mean, insert your, you know, cultural commentary article here, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then you get the next line, or the next stanza, rather. But when I came unto my beds... plural, interestingly there, with toss pots still had drunken heads. So toss pots, is that my thing here says that means drunkards. Is that what is yours?
Yes,
say?
And my note says the unto my beds means old age. So he starts with when I was a child and ends up with, so you see, he grows up and he gets married and now he's an old man.
So he's an old man with drunkards. So if you substitute drunkards for toss pots, with drunkards still had drunken heads.
That's what I'm not exactly sure how to interpret.
Yeah, I'm trying to. So when I get old, drunkards still had drunken heads, basically.
That seems to imply that he's not expecting anybody to actually grow up.
Huh. Well.
But then he ends
now
up with,
we know what happens in the marriages.
but it may also be a comment to the audience. And because the very last stanza is a great while ago the world begun. So he takes it off of this little microcosm of one man and then puts it out into the whole world. But see, the whole idea of a great while ago the world begun to me feels like civilization's been around a really long time, and why are we still a bunch of children? Why aren't we growing up as a culture?
But then at the last line, like you could almost, if you're looking at the alternating lines and you're taking out the refrain.
No,
line,
you're right.
Then the
but that's
then the,
all one our play is done. That's a very dismissive.
Right. So
anything I'm saying too seriously.
I think it ends if you're doing the alternating lines and taking out the refrains. You almost have to end the poem at a great while ago the world begun, and it's really abrupt. And then it gets back to the refrain lines, but then it does your throwaway, but that's all one, our play is done, and we'll strive to please you every day. So like he reverts back to this idea of like pleasure seeking. So is that still wink, wink? Is this the clown being wink, wink at us? Or is he saying, you know, there's nothing, is it pessimistic? Is it a fundamentally pessimistic perspective that he's offering here? Like you're not going to grow up anyway, so we'll just try to do our best to please you.
It seems a little bit pessimistic, and that would suit. I mean, the character of the clown is he's pretty jaded, appropriately so.
He's very jaded.
It's part of the reason that he sees things clearly is that he's not, I don't know, his cynicism has guarded him a little bit.
Okay, so this ending feels a little bit to me like the ending of the Clark's Tale in Chaucer. Do you know what I'm talking about? He gives that long diatribe against women, which is a direction, he's directing it at the wife of Bath, who he's taken issue with because she made some comments negatively about Clark's. And so then clerks, if you're American, but clerks is how Chaucer would have said it. And clerks are scholars. So she makes a dig at scholars. So then he does this big misogynistic rant against women. And then at the end says, but don't take anything I say too seriously. It's just a story and we're all just having fun. And scholars really get into that, right? Like, is he really saying, don't take me seriously? Is he really just trying to make sure the wife of Bath doesn't slap him across the face? Is it like what's happening here where he's just laid out this heavy truth, but now he's going to try to play it off like it's a joke possibly? It just feels sort of the same thing. And Shakespeare was very influenced by Chaucer. There's actually quite a few things that Harold Goddard pointed out about Twelfth Night that was reminiscent of Chaucer.
Doesn't Chaucer publish at the end? What does he call them? Not remissions. He takes back everything that he wrote.
That's at the Clark's Tale. That's what I'm talking about. That's in the Clark's Tale. There's a debate about whether that's Chaucer, the author, speaking, or if it's still the Clark, the character. There's scholarly debate about that.
I thought that there was an actual kind of epilogue that Chaucer attached that said, all of this is wink, wink, joke, joke. And that it's in both the Clark's Tale, but that sentiment is repeated in an epilogue.
Well, he never finished writing it, so there's not an epilogue.
What am I thinking about?
People should really finish their books.
I know. Death, I mean, that's just one of my personal things. Is like, how many great, awesome things have been destroyed by death? Books, I mean. But Chaucer finished it in heaven, and I can't wait.
Okay, hold, I just found my Chaucer, because I'm confused.
Oh, no, I'm going to have to go look at it, too.
Chaucer's retraction. That's what I'm trying to think, that I was trying to recall.
Yes, but that's in the middle, right?
In my Penguin edition, it's at the end.
Huh. Okay, well, all I can say, I'll have to go get mine. I have the World Classics edition, but I will say that the order that the tales go in is a highly debated scholarly mm-hmm. thing, because after he died, they're just in fragments, and so there's a lot of scholarly debate about the order that they go in.
Well, our listeners just walked into a Close Reads episode on Chaucer.
Right.
We should probably work to wrap it up here. So let's table that discussion for now, but we can, you know, I'm sure people will want to talk to you on Facebook about that. Do you, either of you, have any final thoughts for this episode before we jump to answer people's questions next week?
I have no final thoughts.
You know, after how much we got laughed at last week of saying I have no final thoughts and then each running to get our final thoughts in, I'm a little nervous on how to answer this question. So I'll say, I appear to have no final thoughts. Hey ho, the rain will come.
and it is a very rainy day in North Carolina today.
It is.
All right. So hold on a second. Do you have no final thoughts? Is that what we're getting at here? Neither of you?
That is my unofficial off-the-record statement.
Okay. Well, all right then. Let's end before you come up with something. Like I said, we will post a thread on the Facebook page for people who want to submit questions. If you're not on Facebook and you still want to submit, you can email me david@cerseinstitute.com and we'll get to some of those as well. We'll cover as many questions as we can. Which is probably two next week.
That's the way it always goes, isn't it? Two questions and we're done.
But feel free to send as many as you'd like. I'm sure there'll be some overlap.
David, do you want people to hashtag them?
Sure. Let's do hashtag Close Reads Q&A.
Great.
And we'll use the ampersand hashtag Close Reads Q ampersand A. How about that?
Perfect.
And we will, like I said, we'll get to as many as we can. Don't forget about the bonus podcast. And don't forget about checking out the comments, because this week, this month, Brian Phillips has been releasing an episode a week about key figures in church history. And I've been listening to them and they're pretty good. So I recommend that you go subscribe to the comments and catch up on that season if you can. There's some great stuff in there for just during Advent, just contemplating these key figures that, that played such a big role in the development of church history. And so far he's done a lot of early church fathers. I think this week he is running one on St. Francis, maybe? No, not St. Francis. St. Benedict. St. Benedict with David Hicks. So that's going up this week, tomorrow. So lots, lots of great stuff in there. I highly recommend that. The Ask Andrew podcast is going up every Wednesday. Those are short 10-15 minute episodes where he's answering just key questions about classical education, like things like what is the liberal arts? What is the quadrivium? Why does Dorothy Sayers become, her interpretation become so popular? All kinds of stuff like that. So with that, I guess this is it. This is your last chance, Angelina, for a final thought.
Nope. I'd like to phone a friend.
Tim, you're the friend. Would you like to give a final thought?
No, I don't. I have nothing else, David.
Okay, I'm going to do the
friend. Not Tim.
Hey, we're full circle. Back to the friendship thing.
Oh, yeah. Well done, you guys.
I'm going to do 50-50. And option A is keep going on this show. Option B is end the show. I'm going to choose option B and sign off. So for Angelina Stanford and for Tim McIntosh and for all of us here at Circe, I'm David Curran saying farewell on the Close Reads podcast on the Circe Podcast Network.
Oh, and Merry Christmas,
Merry
right?
Christmas. Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend with your family and friends. And we look forward to talking to you next week as we conclude 2017 on Close Reads with the Q&A episode of Twelfth Night.
Archetypes in Space.